I can't get over how good that video is. So hopefully now everyone's awake. It's nearing the end of the day, so I'm really glad we're here all awake and paying attention now.
Yes.
So by show of hands, who slept really well last night? Oh, that's pretty good. And that goes for the virtual audience too, tuning in.
Yeah, hi to our virtual folks.
Yeah, hello to you all. So shout it out, you know, into your office, into your room as well. Who slept okay, like pretty good? Okay, not bad. Now, who has some trouble with sleep last night? Oh, yeah, look around the room. Oh, Dr. Cutler too. Okay, well.
Stayed up too late last night drinking.
Well, that's fair. I think you're allowed.
Alcohol's really good for sleep, I understand, isn't it, Jade?
Yes, you heard it from Dr. Cutler, not from me. So, well, if you looked around the room, you'll have seen that you're certainly not alone. And, you know, this is in a room full of medical professionals, right? So think about how prevalent sleep problems must be for our patients. So I'm really, really excited to be back at NEI talking about my favorite topic, insomnia, and I have the honor of co-presenting with Dr. Cutler this year, so I'm really thrilled.
And me too.
And if I may say so myself, I think we are a really good team.
Hi.
You're representing medicine.
100%.
I represent psychology, and so we're a multidisciplinary team here. So
we are.
Today, what we're really hoping to do is hit a few important learning objectives, including implementing screening tools and assessment tools for helping our patients to catch insomnia early, and also describing the safety, efficacy, and limitations of both pharmacological and non-pharmacological treatment plans, because, you know, as we said, sleep is very multidisciplinary, so we want to bring different tools to the table. We also want to develop effective evidence-based treatment plans that, you know, not only solve the sleep problem at night, but also help patients to function well during the day. So the first thing to know about insomnia is that it's a subjective complaint. So that means that the most integral piece of the diagnostic criteria is the complaint of dissatisfaction. Does this sound familiar from the pretest questions? Right. So the complaint of dissatisfaction with sleep quantity or quality associated with either difficulty falling asleep, difficulty staying asleep, or waking up too early. And these sleep disturbances have to cause significant distress or impairment in at least one domain of functioning. And these disturbances happen about half the nights or more, and they last at least 3 months. And this last point is very important. The disturbances are not attributable to an obvious other cause, like a substance or another psychiatric or medical condition.
Jay, do you know what I don't see on that slide?
What don't you see?
A certain amount of hours per night.
Right.
That's not on there.
How interesting is that?
Wow.
And we also don't see how long does it take for someone to fall asleep.
Right.
Or how long you're awake during the night. So in a way, insomnia is in the eye of the beholder.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
So if you have a patient that takes 20 minutes to fall asleep, but they're really upset about this and they don't function well during the day and they think it's all because they take so long to fall asleep, that's insomnia.
Yep.
But if someone takes 2 hours to fall asleep, but they're not really worried and they're fine, they don't feel it during the day, that's not insomnia.
That's normal for me.
Yeah. Is that normal for you?
No, not me personally. I'm just saying, you know, if a patient says that's normal, then that's not it.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, just because it's subjective doesn't mean it's not very real. Insomnia is very prevalent. So just matching exactly what you see in your clinics, about a third to up to half of the adult population have significant insomnia symptoms, and about 5 to 15% have insomnia that meets diagnostic criteria. And it's very costly too. So every year, insomnia costs the U.S. society over $100 billion in direct and indirect costs. That's a lot of money. And in a six-month period for an individual patient, if they have insomnia, they'll spend about $1,300 more than a peer, a matched peer, who does not have insomnia. And if we have depression in the mix too, someone with depression and insomnia will have about $4,000 more medical costs per six-month period than someone with just depression alone. So this is definitely something we ought to pay attention to. And just as important as knowing what insomnia is what it isn't. So have you heard people talking about insomnia and sleep deprivation interchangeably? right? From your patients, perhaps from the media, even from ourselves, we throw these terms around. But it's really important to know that chronic insomnia and sleep deprivation are actually very different concepts. There is some overlap, but they are separate. And it's important to know the difference because the treatments for those can be the opposite. So I'll tell you why. Let's start with sleep deprivation. This sleep deprivation is when someone doesn't have enough opportunity to sleep. So think of a single mom working three jobs, and she only has 5 hours to lay down each night. That's called sleep deprivation. She doesn't have enough opportunity to sleep. Or there are other environmental or social barriers or poor sleep habits, or, you know, if any of you have kids that are teenagers or college students that are pulling all-nighters to study or to party, then yeah, that's also sleep deprivation, right? While on the other hand, chronic insomnia is not that. That's when someone has plenty of opportunity to sleep, and their sleep environment and their sleep behaviors are generally pretty good, and yet they still have trouble falling or staying asleep. And their sleep troubles are due to psychophysiological hyperarousal and or insufficient sleep drive. So that's not an external source of not being able to sleep, that's more internal. Now, sometimes there are overlaps. There are patients who have comorbid insomnia and another sleep disorder and another medical or psychiatric condition. And sometimes that causes a tricky situation where they have both insomnia symptoms and they're sleep deprived. So that's kind of beyond the scope of this talk, but you know, that's the good news is that those cases are still treatable and the treatments that we'll talk about later are still relevant. All right, so now we've talked about insomnia being a subjective complaint. It's costly, it's prevalent. It is not the same thing as sleep deprivation. So let's talk about how we can screen for it and how we can assess for it in the clinic. So because insomnia is a subjective complaint, as we have already talked about, this requires subjective methods of assessment. So that actually makes our job a little bit easier, right? We don't need big, heavy, expensive equipment. All we need to do is to talk to the patient. In fact, the best screener for insomnia is a single question. It can be verbal, it can be written. You just ask the patient, do you have trouble falling or staying asleep?
Oh.
And that's a pretty good test of whether someone likely has insomnia.
I can do that.
Yeah, that's pretty easy. And it doesn't take up a lot of time in your busy days, right? So that leads easily into the next phase of assessment. If someone says, yes, I do have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep, then we can begin a clinical interview to further understand their sleep-wake behaviors, to rule in insomnia diagnostic criteria, and to rule out conditions that masquerade as insomnia. So we'll talk a little bit about what those are in a moment. And you can actually just use one clinical interview, for example, the Duke Structured Interview for Sleep Disorders. That's my home institution, so I'm proud to represent.
Yep.
And this is really the only instrument you need. You can stop right here. The clinical interview is the only thing you need to diagnose insomnia. But there's a couple of other questionnaires that are nice to have, like the Insomnia Severity Index to give you a better idea of just where your patient is, how severe their symptoms are, and really my favorite thing, the Consensus Sleep Diary. So this is a more in-depth self-report questionnaire that the patient fills out each morning, ideally for about 14 days, and if not, for 7 days, where they tell you in fine-grained detail what their sleep patterns are, like when do they go to bed, when do they turn out the lights to fall asleep, how long does it take them to fall asleep, how many times do they wake up. So over the course of a week or two, you can really get, you can be a fly in their wall and really see what their sleep patterns are. So this is nice to have, but not required. And this is what it looks like, the paper and pencil form, but of course, in this day and age, there are apps for that too, and they're free. Now, let's go back a little bit to the clinical interview. So what exactly are we looking for? We're asking them questions, we're asking them about their sleep history. We're not only looking for insomnia symptoms that match the diagnostic criteria, we're also looking for conditions that masquerade as insomnia to rule those out. So for example, stimulants. How many people here drink coffee? I had a couple cups today myself. How many of your patients drink coffee? or maybe, you know, a few pots of coffee a day, right? I see that in my clinic pretty often. And I think you were telling me backstage about other drinks that are like sports drinks that have caffeine
Absolutely.
In them, and they don't really even advertise the caffeine content.
That's right.
So we do need to really assess, you know, what our patients are putting into their bodies. And it's not just stimulants. If a patient is taking medications that are sedating, such as pain medications, benzodiazepines, they might be napping on and off during the day. And of course, that will disrupt their nighttime sleep. We also want to rule out a lack of opportunity for sleep because, like we talked about earlier, that's sleep deprivation. That's not insomnia. So for example, if someone says, I just had a baby 2 weeks ago, I'm up all night, I can't get any stretch of sleep longer than 60 minutes, well, that's not so much insomnia as, unfortunately, normal parenting. Or, you know, if we have a firefighter or a nurse, as some of you are here at home or in this room, then maybe you're on call 24 hours, or maybe you're working night shifts. So that may not be insomnia disorder. That may be more of a shift work disorder. Now, what about acute changes in medical status or psychiatric status? You know, if someone has surgery last week, well, they may be experiencing a lot of pain and discomfort. They may be, you know, napping during the day to recover. So this may not be insomnia either. And if someone is in an acute mood episode, such as a manic episode, then, you know, there are better explanations for why they're not sleeping than insomnia. However, it is important to note that having a comorbid diagnosis does not preclude an insomnia diagnosis, especially if that other diagnosis is chronic. We just want to make sure that there's not a recent and acute change in status. All right, we also want to assess daytime sleepiness because, believe it or not, most insomnia patients are not sleepy during the day. And I know this sounds really counterintuitive, but if you think about it, if you're sleepy, you're not gonna have trouble falling or staying asleep, right? So if you hear that a patient is having trouble with sleep at night and they're sleepy during the day, that's kind of a red flag actually for us to look for something else, such as another sleep disorder like obstructive sleep apnea or narcolepsy. Oh. So my favorite tools for looking for sleepiness are the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, which is just a checklist of different types of scenarios during the day, like watching a movie, driving a car, in a meeting, and asking the patient how likely they are to fall asleep in each of those scenarios. We can also use the Stop Bang to screen for sleep apnea, which is so common, especially with a middle-aged or older population. Now that we've talked about how to screen for insomnia, you know how to catch it in the clinic, let's get to the really exciting part about how to treat insomnia. So what are the evidence-based treatments for this very prevalent and costly disorder? So let's start out with the behavioral treatments, because I'm a psychologist, this is my wheelhouse. I've listed here the recommended behavioral treatments according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and you'll see cognitive behavioral therapy at the top highlighted. And that's because this is the only therapy that is actually receives a strong recommendation from the AASM. And this is not just the only behavioral treatment that receives the strong recommendation. It is the only treatment, period, out of all the pharmacological and behavioral treatments, because this is the one that has received the most evidence support with the least side effects and maintains the longest effects. So we do want to definitely focus on CBT. And the other ones listed here are really just variations of CBT or components of CBT. So today we'll just focus on CBT itself.
But all of these are evidence-based, right?
They are, yes. So relaxation therapy, you know, stimulus control, sleep restriction, these might sound familiar. Yeah. These are all evidence-based, and they actually all fall under the umbrella of cognitive behavioral therapy.
You know, this morning, Jade, I was presenting a talk on prescription digital therapeutics, PDTs,
yes.
And I talked about Somryst, which is an FDA-approved PDT that delivers CBTI.
Yes, I'm so glad to see these CBTI products that can really scale and really reach a lot more people, because not a lot of us are trained in CBT, and so it's really nice to see those options. Yeah. Excellent. So let's talk a little bit more about what CBT is exactly. So it's a multi-component behavioral treatment, and it addresses the biobehavioral and psychosocial mechanisms of chronic insomnia. Or in other words, it really gets to the roots of the issue. It is the first-line treatment recommended by the American College of Physicians and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. And you might be surprised to learn that it's a brief treatment. It doesn't involve 6 months of treatment, a year of sitting on the couch. It's 4 to 8 sessions. And a lot of my patients, 2 to 3 sessions. You know, so it. This is a piece of optimism you can talk about with your patients that, believe it or not, you've had insomnia for 15 years. We can turn this around in a matter of a few weeks. And it is efficacious and cost-effective, and the effects are maintained long-term. In fact, one of my colleagues who's done a few trials of CBTI, she's fabulous. She tried to do a follow-up analysis of her trials of 2-year follow-up data to see, you know, what are the predictors of relapse? She could not do the analysis because only 2 patients out of almost 200 relapsed.
Wow.
I mean, how often do we see data like that, right? So I'm just really astounded time and again by how effective this treatment is. Wow. And it is preferred by both clinicians and patients. You know, when people know about this option, they tend to opt for it. And, you know, it is extensively studied. At this point, we have over 100 high-quality RCTs on this topic in various populations. So we're confident when we talk about CBTI. Now, what happens in CBTI in these brief treatment or brief sessions? Well, the goal is to drive up homeostatic sleep drive, which is the accumulation of adenosine in the brain, or in layman's terms, that's your hunger for sleep. We want to drive that up. And we want to decrease psychophysiological arousal, or in layman's terms, that's your body and brain being too revved up. Now, how do we do that? We do that by changing behaviors. So, for example, we restrict the patient's time in bed, because often people with insomnia spend way too much time in bed. So they don't have enough time outside of bed to be building up that sleep drive, which I describe as saving up sleepiness coins in your piggy bank. So you need enough time outside of bed, and bonus points if you're physically active and socially active. You need enough time to save up those coins. We also have patients follow a consistent sleep-wake schedule, and that really regularizes their circadian rhythm, and that helps the brain to tell the person when they should be sleepy and when they should be awake. We also use stimulus control. This boils down to don't do anything other than sleep in bed. Now, sex is an exception, and I also make reading an exception, or really just anything that's like relaxing. That's fine too. I'm pretty lenient about this. But generally, we want to save the bed for sleep and sleep only. And if someone is not sleeping, having trouble falling asleep or getting back to sleep, they need to get out of bed so they're not associating the bed with frustration and anxiety and wakefulness. Mm. We want to decrease other unhelpful behaviors too, like watching the clock. Now, who here has watched the clock? Ticking away the hours and counting down to how many hours you still have left, getting more and more frustrated. I only have 4 more hours, I only have 3 more hours. Now, how often has that helped you relax and get back to sleep?
Nah, not so.
Why don't we just cover up that clock with a t-shirt and be done with it, right? So these are the things we want to work with our patients with about. Also important, cognitive changes. We want to provide the patient with education to correct some common misconceptions about sleep. For example, how often have you heard a patient say, you know, I want to sleep like I did when I was 20, when I was 30, meanwhile they're turning 60 next month, and you're like, well, do you do other things like you did when you were 20 and 30? Maybe not, right? Maybe some aspects of life, but we can't expect everything to stay the same. And it's okay for sleep to change over time, you know, because our brains and our bodies need different things as we age. And we also want to identify and challenge unhelpful thoughts that patients have throughout the day, like or throughout the night. Like, oh, I won't be able to function tomorrow unless I fall asleep right now. Not usually a very relaxing thought. So, you know, we help the patient ask themselves, well, have there been times in the past when I didn't sleep well, but I functioned well anyways the next day? Or I slept pretty well, but I had a crappy day anyway the next day. So how closely tied really is that relationship? And can we cut ourselves some slack? So hopefully by the end of your work with the patient, they acknowledge that yes, sleep changes naturally with time, and yeah, I can probably do fine tomorrow, even if I don't sleep a full 8 hours tonight. and they'll probably be more relaxed and fall asleep better. We also teach some other skills and concepts like relaxation skills to decrease their physiological arousal. We give them further education that's tailored to them to help them have realistic expectations about their own sleep patterns. And we also give them sleep-wake hygiene, such as not drinking too much coffee, not drinking too much alcohol, because turns out that doesn't actually help you sleep better. just generally shaping a person's sleep-wake behaviors such that they can, give themselves the best chances for sleep and also still live their life and have fun. So that's pretty much CBTI in a nutshell.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm excited now to hear about pharmacological treatments for sleep.
Well, first of all, thank you, Jade. I actually learned a lot. Did anybody else learn something there? Yeah, that was great.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. That was really fun.
That was really helpful. I'll have to be honest, being someone whose main tool in my toolbox is my prescribing power, I didn't realize that, hey, you know what? Medicines aren't the first line treatment. We really should be using these other modalities. But when we do need to use pharmacology, let's try to be reasonable and evidence-based. So, as we've said, pharmacologic treatments are not considered first line treatments. Very important to understand. Most FDA-approved insomnia drugs are meant for short-term use. And yet, in the real world, Jade, I think they get used chronically a lot. The advantages, of course, they're very accessible, they work pretty rapidly, they're effective in some ways, but there's risks, of course. There ain't no free. The side effects, as we know, significant side effects in some cases. Some of them have the risk of physiologic and psychological dependence and are maybe controlled substances, building up of tolerance, or so-called tachyphylaxis. And then especially for older adults, we're really concerned about cognition and things like falls and balance problems, right? And then, as we heard from Jade, of course, pills don't teach skills, right, Jade?
That's correct.
Pills don't teach skills, so they're not addressing these other issues here, the behavioral, the psychological, social mechanisms, if you will. But if we have to talk about medication, let's at least start from understanding what are the FDA-approved treatments. And those of you who've been coming to NEI for a while, probably a little tired of hearing me say this, but we should always start with an FDA-approved or at least evidence-based treatment. So here we have the benzodiazepine hypnotics. Not all benzodiazepines are FDA-approved for insomnia, but many of them are, as you see here. The so-called non-benzodiazepine Z drugs, we like to call them, because you can see they all have Zs in there. As far as antidepressants, not everybody may realize this, but there is a low-dose formulation of doxepin, an older tricyclic antidepressant that is actually FDA-approved for insomnia. We, of course, have the newer orexin antagonists, and there are now three. The newest one is daridorexant. And then we have one melatonin receptor agonist. Now, interestingly, there are a couple of melatonin receptor agonists on the market. One of them, tasimelteon, is approved for non-24, but not for insomnia specifically, sort of a funny quirk. Then, of course, we use over-the-counter melatonin, but it's not FDA-approved. Antipsychotics, okay. Over 70% of you got this right. But Jade and I are greedy. We want 100%. Notice, quetiapine is not FDA approved. Was that loud enough?
Maybe a little louder.
A little louder, okay. Quetiapine! And those of you at home, are you listening? Quetiapine is not FDA approved.
Nope.
Neither is olanzapine. And then anticonvulsants, which interestingly, I have to be honest, I have sometimes prescribed, especially gabapentin at times, especially if someone has pain or some other associated symptoms. But here you see, these are the ones that are commonly used. Many of these are evidence-based, and many of them are FDA approved. All right, let's kind of run through them here. We've got the benzodiazepine hypnotics. How do they work? Well, they bind to GABA-A receptors, especially intrasynaptic GABA-A receptors, and there is a very specific benzodiazepine binding site on certain GABA-A receptors that tend to be intrasynaptic. There's also extrasynaptic GABA-A receptors that are probably part of the neurosteroid story, especially the neurosteroids that treat depression, but this is benzodiazepines. The GABA-A receptors are made up of five subunits. There's alpha here, you can see. And there are other subunit types, but the benzos bind specifically to certain alpha subunits of the GABA receptor, and they are basically agonists. Alpha subunit expression differs throughout the brain, so benzodiazepines don't necessarily bind everywhere, but they bind to a lot of places. The selectivity of a hypnotic for different alpha subunits will induce effects in addition to sedation. So we know benzodiazepines have a lot of effects in addition to their sleep inducing effects, including anti-anxiety, anti-pain, but also tolerance and euphoria, if you will, or the problems with abuse. Higher risk of tolerance and withdrawal effects compared to the non-benzodiazepine hypnotics. The non-benzodiazepine hypnotics are selective. They bind to certain subunits of the GABA-A receptor, not all of these alpha subunits that benzos. So benzos, think of them as kind of more generalized, less specific, binding to a lot more of the subunits. Okay, we have estazolam and flurazepam, quazepam, and tamazepam, the PAMs, right? These are all FDA approved, and triazolam. Of course, they're not the only ones we use, but those are all FDA approved. Now the non-benzodiazepine, the Z drugs, these bind selectively to one or two of the alpha subunits. And let me back up and show you here what we're talking about. Remember, there's alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and alpha 5. So the benzos are binding to several of these alpha subunit types. And again, that gives you not only treatment for sleep, but also these other effects. Whereas the non-benzos, by being more selective, it is thought that they're working more for sleep and have less of those other effects. So they're a little more selective. And here, as we said, especially the alpha 2 and alpha 3 subunits, we think may have some of these other properties. We have S-zopiclone, which is selective for alpha 2 and alpha 3, the only hypnotic approved, interestingly, for chronic use. That is very interesting, S-zopiclone. We have zalpilon, selective for alpha 1. Can be used for awakening during the night without residual effects. That one has a very short half-life. That's probably why that is. And then the old standby Zolpidem, selective for alpha 1. There's now a sublingual form for middle of the night awakening. There's been some label changes you need to be aware of here because of the risk of next morning impairment. And the FDA recently recommended bedtime doses be lowered, especially for women and especially for Zolpidem. So now the dose we used to recommend was 10 milligrams. Now it's recommended to try 5 milligrams first and then consider 10. Again, especially for women who appear to be more sensitive. And then for the extended release formulation, again, cut it in half. S-zopiclone from 3 down to 1 milligrams. Now this brings up an important point. The world that I partly live in is the research world, the clinical trials world, and you may all realize there's a real disconnect sometimes between the doses we study in a clinical trial and what clinicians sort of find out is really the best dose. And I like to say I do the research that gets the drug on the market, and then the real research begins, and you guys figure it out. So this is something that we've learned, I think, after these drugs were approved. Okay, let's move on now to some of the antidepressant drugs that are used as hypnotics, especially trazodone, which is also not FDA approved for insomnia, but doxepin is. And one of the things we take advantage of here is differential dosing for the different indication. So trazodone at the antidepressant dose, which is actually closer to 300 milligrams and above, you can see here actions at many different receptors and the serotonin transporter, SERT. And these are thought to be antidepressant effects, but it also has prominent, as you can see here, antihistamine effects, so it can be very sedating. But also we've got effects on alpha receptors. At the lower doses, we still have enough antihistamine property and effects on alpha-1 antagonism, both of which are sedating kinds of mechanisms that we can get away with hypnotics. Now, in my experience, I don't know about you, and Jade, I don't know what you hear, but in my experience, trazodone, sometimes I get into chasing my tail. I find it works for a while to dose, and then I kind of have to go up.
I have heard of that.
Yeah, and that can be a problem. Of course, the anti-alpha-1 can lead to problems with dizziness, orthostatic hypotension, and that, as we said, in elderly folks can be a real big deal. Mm-hmm. Doxepin, look at how multimodal it is at the higher doses that we used to use it for depression. You can see all these different effects. Obviously, it works on, it's an SNRI, essentially, right? but it also has some effects on alpha-1 and histamine. And at very low doses here, look at how much lower, single-digit milligrams, you basically have an antihistamine here. All right, now let's move on to some really exciting stuff. This is the new class of medicines, the orexin receptor antagonists. Now, the first thing you need to know is that there are two different kinds of orexin receptors, the orexin 1 and the orexin 2, and you can work at both or you can work at one. So we have SORAs, which are single orexin receptor antagonists, and you can actually have one that works only at the orexin 1 receptor, or there's one in development now that's working on the orexin 2 receptor called seltorexant. Seltorexant is being studied for insomnia associated with depression, kind of specifically, and there's some interesting neurobiology around the orexin system and mood regulation. Then we have the DORAs. DORAs bind to both, and we have three of those on the market now. The first was suvorexant, then came lemborexant, and the newest, which has, in my opinion, very favorable pharmacokinetics, is daridorexant. And I hope you have learned and kept up a little bit with these medicines. Oh my gosh, how do these drugs work? Well, the orexin system is part of the body's natural arousal system. It's also called hypocretin, the hypocretin orexin system. And you can see here that this system, again, is promoting, if you stimulate the system, you're promoting wakefulness. So obviously, if you block these receptors, you are decreasing that hyperarousal alertness, and you're sending a signal to the body, hey, it's time to go to sleep here. So as you can see here, we block these receptors, and it's really fascinating to see the wide-ranging effects on various parts of the brain that have to do with arousal, the interactions with various monoamines that are particularly arousing, such as norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin, as you can see here. Really fascinating. Notice also at the bottom of the slide, the orexin system is also not only implicated in arousal and sleep, but also in feeding behaviors, in motivation and reward. And this is where there's some overlap in the circuitry of mood disorders with the orexin system. Okay, let's talk a little more here. So lemborexant, suvorexant, and daridorexant all block these receptors. So we have, notice there's orexin A and orexin B, and you see here we've got the orexin 1 and the orexin 2 receptors. So we've got here lemborexant and suvorexant and daridorexant. Both are blocking these G protein coupled receptors, the traditional lock and key receptors, and that affects intracellular second messenger systems, and as you see here, induce sleep. Here's some of the data on suvorexant, which clearly showed efficacy. It's a little hard to read here, but what we're looking at here is various subjective measures of sleep. And if I'm not mistaken, gosh, my eyes are getting worse. It's one of the things that changed with age. I don't sleep as well, I don't see as well. But you can see here the change from baseline in the total sleep time and total time to sleep onset. So it's both falling asleep and staying asleep. And you can see here clearly both doses here of suvorexant were superior to placebo. Lemborexant, same thing, FDA approved. And it's approved at both 5 and 10 milligram doses for insomnia. This is some of the data on daridorexant. And here we have a whole variety, again, of different sleep parameters. So we have the change in wake after sleep onset. So wake after sleep onset. We've got latency to persistent sleep. We've got total sleep time. And in all cases here, daridorexant was better than placebo at improving these various measures of sleep.
And daridorexant is the newest drug on the market, right?
This is daridorexant, you're right. There is suvorexant, lemborexant, and this is daridorexant.
Yeah, I think I just recently heard about it.
Yeah. Exciting. Well, what's interesting is the pharmacokinetics. The other two drugs have very long half-lives, so the risk is obviously sedation the next day. Mm-hmm. This drug has a shorter half-life, and it's also the only one that has demonstrated improvement in daytime functioning, which, as we know, we talked about, I think it's very important.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so, wow. Look at that. We're right on time here.
Pretty good.
In summary, and I hope you guys at home caught this too, and I realize that this is a little complicated, some of the biology. Please learn more on your own. Please continue to update your knowledge base on this. You know, a few years ago, we didn't have these orexin drugs, and we didn't know as much about the orexin system. Now we're all learning about it, so it's great. Right, so here's what we hope that we communicated, Jade. Insomnia is prevalent, as we know, characterized by psychophysiological hyperarousal and insufficient homeostatic sleep drive, resulting in trouble falling and or staying asleep, daytime symptoms, fatigue and impairment, and distress and impairment. So as you well said, it's a subjective experience. And to screen and diagnose insomnia, all you need, boy, we're trying to give them the answer here. All you need is a clinical interview. Yeah, you can use PSG polysomnography and all kinds of other techniques. And I use a lot of those scales you talked about in clinical trials. I've done a number of insomnia studies. We've used the Epworth Sleepiness Scale, the Insomnia Sleep Index, all those things. Okay, so we want to assess nighttime and daytime symptoms. Of course, we want to do a careful medical evaluation to look at medical causes of insomnia, especially sleep apnea. I'm glad you mentioned that. And sleep apnea, as you know, is associated not only with insomnia, but with depression. So in your sleepy, depressed patients, please consider sleep apnea, very important. And also look at all the medications they're taking. I have a trick I like to do. I call it the shopping bag trick, Jade.
Ooh, what's that?
I tell my patients, fill up a shopping bag with every pill bottle in your house, everything you're taking, whether it's over the counter, prescribed, not prescribed. And to your point about these, a lot of these drinks that people drink, there's a lot of supplements over the counter that have these ingredients that you can't pronounce. And when you look them up, they're all alkaloids, which are stimulants. They're relatives of cocaine and caffeine. So you want to know everything they're taking, and you may be very surprised what you find that may be influencing their sleep. Evidence-based treatments, as we heard very clearly, include CBTI, and that's actually the recommended first-line treatment. These hopefully help with behavioral changes to increase sleep drive and decrease hyperarousal. Cognitive changes also decrease anxiety around sleep. And other components provide education and self-efficacy. And what I'm really impressed with, Jada, is the persistence of the effect. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
It's not hard, of course, to do another course again if you need to.
Sure.
And then we talked about the pharmacologic approaches to insomnia, including some newer agents working on the orexin systems.